another episode of We the People Radio. My name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located on 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Anything mowers, commercial or residential, they've got it up there.
You need a small tractor?
Small tractors all the way up the line, so no matter how big you want it, they've got it up there in stock. So stop by and see them or give them a call at 226-9226. Or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And they have generators.
Oh, they got generators.
A bunch of other stuff, too. Oh, and if you're looking for Christmas stuff, if you have kids or people in your world that want John Deere swag, they have everything.
Yeah, got a lot of swag in there.
They just have, like, clothes and toys and...
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Go up and see them. They can get you fixed up for Christmas.
And there you go. All righty. So you can also find them at our website, which is wethepeopleradio.us. We've got archives going back like 9 years on all sorts of topics. And if you've missed the shows about China, I would encourage you to go back and listen. They are free to listen to, and they have taken – we have taken the capitalism out We left the original capitalism in for our sponsor, but we took all the other ones out. So, you know, you can listen commercial free and at no charge, which is, I mean, it just doesn't get handier than that, really. And you've got lots of different topics. But all the China shows are clustered on a tab at the top. And shows about Islam, environmentalism, marijuana, stuff like that. I think we're going to go back to environmentalism because, well, I miss it. And it's just fun to, you know, just a fun topic to do. So we'll work on getting more of those shows. But today we get to go in the Wayback Machine. We get to talk about 1177 BC, the year civilization ended, with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. And I have no idea what this topic is about, so we are literally along for the ride. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission, which is how we got connected with him in the first place, because the whole EMP situation is obviously not being very, very widely disseminated in just out in the public, and the media is doing a terrible job. So we thought we would up the bar there and not be the media that does the terrible job. Let's see what else has he done. He is on the House. He was part of the House, or is part of the House Armed Services Committee. I guess we should circle up on that and find out what's happening with that, and also the infamous CIA. We have some fun songs for that. We will have to play them for Dr. Pry. I don't think we've ever goofed off during his show, so we might have to accidentally play our fun CIA song. And he is the author of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. Both are available at createspace.com and amazon.com. And you can find the previous shows we've done with him. We talked about the impeachment and the future of Turkey, the Kurds, and the future of NATO. We talked about the PG&E blackouts and the national power grid. You know how that all connects up, because that's obviously... kind of a spoiler alert, actually. California got to find out what it would be like in a very limited fashion, and it would not be pretty. So, Dr. Pry, you want to jump right into 1177 BC, or you want to tell us what's going on in Virginia? You gave me a little snippet in your email.
Well, let's start off with 1177 BC.
Yeah, why not?
And work our way
to Virginia.
Toward the fall of civilization, right? Toward contemporaneous times.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. You know, basically, I was originally trained. I've got two PhDs. My first is in history and archaeology, and the second was in strategic studies. And I had been considering going into the field of archaeology or teaching history. But they say those who can do and those who can't teach. And so through dint of fate and chance, I ended up going to work in the field of strategic studies at the CIA, and the rest is sort of history from there. But I always, I think the best training for modern strategic studies and understanding world history and world events is the past history. And so I continue to read about history and write about history. And I also like to escape in the past from our very scary and often disappointing present by reading about the past. And so I picked up this book, 1177 B.C., The Year Civilization Ended, hoping to escape from EMP by reading this book. And it actually turns out to be extremely relevant to EMP, but I'll get to that later. Basically, Eric Klein, the author of this book, is a Oxford historian, Oxford University historian and archaeologist. And what he's talking about is the first of the two great dark ages that happened in Western civilization. You know, 1177 B.C., this is about, you know, 12 centuries before Christ, there was a dark ages that ended civilization as we knew it up to that time. And, you know, those of you who are familiar with the Old Testament have probably heard of civilizations like Babylon and the Hittites, Ur, and of course the ancient Egyptians of that time. And maybe you've wondered what happened to those civilizations, because outside of the Old Testament, you know, they don't exist anymore. And except for the Egyptians, you know, what happened is this first Dark Ages. Apparently, you know, Western Europe was invaded by barbarians called the Sea People. We don't know who they are or really where they came from. Most of what we know about them comes to us from the Egyptians and from records that were preserved in Babylonian texts. And civilization at this time, 12 centuries before Christ, had actually reached a very high level. We tend not to think of it as such, but it did. They had, there were like five different centers of civilization: Egypt, the Hittites, the Babylonians, a couple of others, who all had writing systems. They had developed writing, they had developed mathematics, they had developed astronomy, they were building cities, and they had sophisticated agricultural economies and sophisticated trade going on in the Mediterranean. So they had, this was basically the first civilizations that rose up in the agricultural revolution, you know, that followed the, you know, the last ice age. And the Sea People, who were at a much lower level of technological development, they were basically, you know, hunter-gatherers and herders. They didn't live a settled existence in cities. And these, we don't know why they came on. It may have been other barbarian groups that pushed them out of Eurasia or something. But they quickly discovered that or maybe it wasn't intentional, they fell down upon these agricultural civilizations and, stole the crops. They made it unsafe to travel on the roads. They even took to sea, which is why they were called the Sea People. They tried crossing the sea into Egypt, which is the one place where they were finally defeated. The Egyptians managed to turn them back in a titanic struggle that the Egyptians tell us about in their history. But as a consequence of these raids by the Sea People, the incursion of these barbarian hordes, they basically knocked the technological props out from the critical infrastructures that sustained civilization at that time. And there was mass starvation, the fall of the cities, the populations dwindled away to nothing. Literature and art, architecture, which was at a highly developed level among all of these civilizations, disappeared. Mathematics disappeared. Writing disappeared. From everybody except the Egyptians. The Egyptians are the only ones who kind of crawled through it. And even they were at a much diminished level after the 12th century. And civilization basically blinked out everywhere except, you know, its remnants in Egypt. Blinked out for about five centuries. We entered a period of dark ages, 12 centuries before Christ that lasted about five or six or seven centuries, actually. I think it's 7 centuries was the length of that Dark Ages. And didn't come out of it until the rise of the Greek city-states, Athens, and what is now known as the classical civilization of early Greece, where writing came back, plays came back, architecture and mathematics is recovered. And basically the story of 1177 BC, that's, he uses that date because that's the date that the Egyptians give for that battle that turns away the sea people. You know, but at around the same time, everybody else was being inundated by them.
Hold that thought. I was trying to find a good spot, but it's hard. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Peter Pry.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. Body, then they go. What shall we do about them?
In the town where I was raised, clock ticks and the cattle graze. Time passed with amazing grace back where I come from. You could lie on a riverbank, paint your name on the water tank, discount all the beers you drank back where I come from.
My only history song. We're back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry.
Well, the big important message from this, because this is a the book 1177 BC, it doesn't just represent Klein's point of view, but it represents an archaeological and historical consensus that is fairly recent, that has been built up over many decades of research, that civilization, Western civilization, ended around that time, centuries before Christ, and then had to make a comeback after a Dark Ages that lasted about 7 centuries. Now, you have to put this into context. Another thing that's interesting about this is that now we know Western civilization ended twice. Because after the comeback and the beginning of the revival of Western civilization, about five or six centuries before Christ, beginning with the rise of classical Greek civilization that we all know about, and that our modern Western civilization is based on the rise of Athenian democracy, the plays, the mathematics, all of that, we can pretty much trace our own politics and culture and science back to the ancient Greeks and the Romans. You know, we had a flowering of Western civilization rising up again from the classical Greeks through the Roman period until about 476 A.D. when Western civilization collapsed again. And again, it was because of barbarian invasions, people who were at a much lower level of technological sophistication. Except by the time of Rome, when Rome fell in 476 A.D., they were much more advanced technologically and, you know, philosophically and in terms of politics and every other measure you want to, much more advanced than those earlier agrarian civilizations. You can see this in the size of the cities. Like Rome had over 1 million people, aqueducts, a road system that was unrivaled until the United States highway system of the 1950s under the Eisenhower administration. 50,000 miles of paved Rome, roads that tied the Roman Empire together. And even more sophisticated international trade roots, the beginnings of early industrialization, actually. The Romans invented, you know, the water wheel and actually had mass production going on, until all of that again came down because of various barbarian raids, you know, the Visigoths, the Vandals, you know, numerous of them, all of them at a much lower level of technological sophistication than the Romans. But like the sea people, you know, they learned that if they knocked the critical infrastructures out from under the Roman Empire by destroying the aqueducts and making the roads unsafe to travel and raiding seaports and raiding the sea lanes and destroying the economies that undergirded this civilization, the classical civilization of Rome, they brought it all down. They brought it all down, you know, within about a century. 476 AD is basically sort of the symbolic culmination of that, with the destruction of Rome itself by barbarians. After that, you know, the population of Rome fell very rapidly with the loss of the technology that made the Roman Empire possible, going from a population of 1 million people to merely 10,000 people. And that's sort of symbolic of what happened. The new Dark Ages that came on, this next phase of the Dark Ages, you know, lasted longer than the prior Dark Ages. You know, historians estimate that it was more than 1,000 years, actually close to 1,400, 1,500 years, because if you sort of measure the sophistication of civilization, one measure that has been used is, you know, how long did it take to get from Londinium, which was London during the Roman period, the Romans founded London, how long did it take to get from London to Rome when the empire was around? Well, it was actually possible, because of the road system, to get from London to Rome faster until the early 19th century, you know, with the building of the railroads. It took that long for civilization to come back in that respect, and even longer in some respects. You know, literacy, for example, was extremely widespread. Even slaves knew how to read. But popular literacy didn't come back to Western civilization until the early 19th century and the public schools movement. If you think of basic things like pure water, you know, the Romans were very healthy people because of their aqueducts and the bath system. Even Prince Albert, who was Queen Victoria's husband, died from cholera from drinking, because they were drinking water from the Thames River, which was extremely polluted. I mean, it's just another example of, you know, the technological backwardness that civilization faced and didn't come out of for 14 or 15 centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire. And sort of the lesson learned about the lessons you can derive from these two dark ages is, first, civilization can come to an end. A more primitive, technologically inferior group of people, if they are smart enough to knock the technological props out from under your civilization, they can make your civilization go away and go into a long dark ages. The other lesson is that the higher you are, the bigger you are, the harder you fall. Once you lose those technological infrastructures that made your civilization great, it takes a longer and longer time. The more sophisticated you are, the longer it takes to get it back. And now, I told you I had picked up this book, 1177 BC, to escape EMP, as a sort of to learn, but also as a sort of escapist reading. But imagine my surprise when I got toward the end. I remember I was on an airplane killing time between briefings, and I got to the last chapter, and I came across a paragraph about EMP attack.
Oh, wow.
And Klein, the Oxford archaeologist and historian, writing about, you know, the first great dark ages, 12 centuries before Christ, he likens it to what could happen to Western civilization again if there's an EMP attack. And that just struck me, that here is this Oxford-educated archaeologist and historian who understands the threat And yet we're having such a hard time getting it into the brains of people like at the Department of Homeland Security, who are actually responsible for protecting against these threats. So Klein gets it and actually incorporated EMP into part of his book. And in effect, what I'm worried about, he verifies, you know, that we could be standing on the threshold of a third Great Dark Ages. You know, because as listeners of this show know, you know, if there's a natural EMP from the sun, you know, from a solar superstorm like the 1859 Carrington event recurring, as there almost was back in July 23rd or 2012, or if we have a nuclear EMP attack as a Christmas present from North Korea, or from any of our other adversaries, it would knock the technological props out from our critical infrastructures, destroy us as an electronic civilization, and plunge us into two dark ages from which there might be no recovery. How long would it take, you know, if we not only lost our critical infrastructures, but if we had a great dying out, as has happened after the other dark ages? You know, the EMP Commission warns that if we had a blackout in North America that lasted 1 year, 90% of our population could die from starvation, disease, and societal collapse. How do you come back from something like that? And would we even have the knowledge? How long would it take to rebuild the scientific and technological knowledge, you know, to, for example, to know how to make an extra high voltage transformer?
Well, forget that. I mean,
big generators.
People don't know how to make regular things without looking at a YouTube video.
Yeah,
exactly.
You take that away, or you even lose the people that have the knowledge, then here you are. You're kind of stuck. You're going to have to kind of reinvent the wheel.
Literally.
Yeah.
We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You can ponder that while we're celebrating capitalism here. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Dr. Pry, you've ruined my one source of happiness in the dire circumstances we often find ourselves in today's world. I think about the plague, because I was an English major, so, you know, we read a lot of that kind of stuff. And I always think about the plague, and I think, oh, in the Dark Ages, nobody could read. I mean, that must have been really bad.
Yeah.
And yet, we came back from that.
Yeah, wiped out half the world's
population. So, you know,
population,
it's not that bad right now.
Yeah.
Like,
I
guess it's no longer a cheery point.
I think people don't understand just how dark the Dark Ages were.
I don't think they do either.
You know?
Good point.
And I should point out, for example, if you look at the period of the Roman Empire, before the fall of the Rome, you can go to England, a place called Vindolandia, all right? And they've actually recovered letters and writings from normal, ordinary foot soldiers, you know, who were writing back to their relatives in Rome. We have a one of the ladies who was posted to Hadrian's Wall with her husband, had a birthday party, and we actually have the card she sent out inviting her friends to attend her birthday party. Simple things.
Wow.
So everybody, I mean, literacy was so widespread, if you just use that as one example. I've got a book on my shelf. I'm wandering back and forth across one of my library here, and there's an interesting book by a guy named Plant about women writers of the ancient Greece and Rome. And, you know, basically it's a thick book that lists thousands of women who wrote all kinds of things, plays and poetry and songs during the classical period. You know, and I think literacy is probably a good measure of civilization and how commonplace it was. But then you go into the Dark Ages. The reason we call them the Dark Ages, as you point out, is we have almost nothing. You know, the literacy goes away. Almost everything we know from the fall of the Roman Empire to the year about to about 1000 A.D. is based on five written sources. You know, monks, basically. Only monks and highborn ladies, some of the highborn ladies, still knew how to read and write during the Dark Ages. Take the Emperor Charlemagne, you know, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, most powerful man in Europe during a period of the Dark Ages. He couldn't even write his name. He was totally illiterate. He only learned one of his proudest achievements was in his 60s, his daughter taught him to write his name.
Wow.
That's how bad things got.
Yeah.
You know? And so the Dark Ages really were really dark, and a lot of modern politically correct historians dislike us calling them the Dark Ages, but they completely deserve that name. In addition to that, of course, you had the people like the Vikings and, you know, a almost complete collapse of what we would call, you know, centralized government. You know, Europe falling into the hands of barons and various warlords, you know, who ended up fighting barbarians. I mean, that was one of the reasons there wasn't a lot of literature. There wasn't a lot of leisure time to do, but just stay alive by trying to get your peasants and serfs to grow food and enforce very draconian laws to ensure that they would provide food to the nobles and to defend that from large bands of robbers and thieves and raiders like you know, like the Vikings.
And then there was the mortality problem. You know, with basic,
right.
You know, basic germs and all that.
Right. People had a much longer lifetime during the classical period of Rome because of, you know, pure water, pure the availability of food and all the rest. And that all changed in the Dark Ages so that, you know, people's longevity greatly decreased. And that didn't really come, again, is an example of something that didn't really come back because of the poor sedate of medicine and sanitation. You know, until the early 19th century.
Yeah, that's really a kind of an eye opener because you stop and think about it. The people that die are the intellects and the scholars because they can't make it on their own. They, you know, they don't know how to grow food and do the manual labor. And I think that would probably be the case today if something like that happened. The people that are currently living on the streets will be the survivors.
Dr. Pry, I'm pretty sure you're not watching these kinds of movies, but, you know, some of us have watched them. And there's a movie out there called Idiocracy that was never intended to be a documentary film. However, I think in looking at it now, and it shows the very beginning. I'll send you a link to that. The very, very beginning, and it shows who's overpopulating. And it isn't the brain trust.
I have heard of that movie. And, you know, I have been wanting to watch it because I thought, you know,
yes.
I thought it sounded like a good critique.
Well, it's a frightening thing, but if you have to attend meetings with government bureaucrats, there's another particular scene in there. It's 2 minutes of pure gold about a product called Brondo. And They've invented Brondo. It's kind of like a sports drink, and Brondo takes over the food pyramid and the EPA and everything else, and so they use Brondo for everything. So they can't grow crops because they don't use water. And anyway, it has electrolytes, and that's the whole circle. It's like, well, why do you put Brondo in everything? Well, it's got electrolytes. It's what plants crave, because that's the slogan of the company. It's like, you know, we might be there now.
Yeah.
This could be happening.
I think we are.
It
brings us to our second topic, I guess.
I segued with Brondo. That's awesome.
Which is what is going on here in Virginia. But before we get to Virginia, maybe we should talk about it, the context of the larger decline, larger deterioration of civilization, because that is what this impeachment actually represents. I don't think people really appreciate what a rare thing a constitutional republic is. There haven't been that many of them in history, and usually it's, you know, because it's very hard. It takes hard work to maintain a constitutional republic. It's got to have an educated people. The government derives not only its legitimacy from the consent of the governed, but the governed themselves are supposed to watch the government like hawks and be jealous of their freedoms and guard their freedoms against the tendency of government to want to take those freedoms away. And that's why you have a constitutional republic, to protect yourself from tyranny. Unfortunately, in the long, sad history of mankind, most civilizations do end up living under authoritarian systems or totalitarian systems, under tyrannies of some kind. And but it takes hard work, you know, to be a citizen of a constitutional republic. You can't be lazy, you know, about intellectual lazy, and you've got to be, you know, jealous of your freedoms. And now with this, the articles of impeachment that were launched last week and next week and this coming week, we're going to see the President of the United States actually impeached on completely illegitimate and unconstitutional grounds. I don't know if I've said it on your show before, but I've said it on other shows, that I think that the day Nancy Pelosi launched the impeachment inquiry, which had no legal or constitutional or common sense basis, and I think she did that on the 24th of September, I might be mistaken, but I think that's the date, you know, you could argue that our constitutional republic ceased to exist on that day. Because you can't have a constitutional republic unless all parties respect the Constitution and respect law and the processes of law and play by the rules. It's not truly a constitutional republic when only one party respects the Constitution and obeys the law and plays by the rules. You know, what we've got now is basically one party that respects the Constitution but and another party that doesn't, that amounts to a totalitarian movement where their highest loyalty is to their party and their own power, not to the Constitution and not to the larger society. And they want to gain control by any means necessary, including an illegal and unconstitutional impeachment, hoping that they will be able to win the next elections thereby so that they can then impose their tyrannical value system on the rest of society. And if this sounds like an exaggeration to you, or if I sound crazy, just look at what's happening in Virginia now, which on the Second Amendment issue, which I think the left feels safest going after people's Second Amendment rights, to take those away, because when it comes to gun rights, you know, guns are among the least popular cause among the vast, uneducated, largely uneducated American electorate. And so that they might be able to make the best case for starting there. And as the founders understood and warned, you know, Jefferson, for example, believed that the Second Amendment was the most important of the rights, the natural rights that Americans enjoyed, because it guaranteed all the others. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about the fact that that they were a revolutionary generation, those who wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They were a revolutionary generation. The first battle of the American Revolution, Lexington and Concord, was fought to stop the British tyranny from taking away the guns of the American militia and their ammunition. That's what they were doing, going to Lexington and Concord to try to disarm the Patriot side. And if you have a disarmed populace, then they become sheep. Mm-hmm. They become much more manageable. They become subject to whatever you want to do to them. And this is why communist systems, for example, wherever they are, whether it was in Russia or China or in Cambodia during Pol Pot, one of the first things they do is they take away people's guns, you know, so that they can then have their way with you.
And there are a lot of people who, they don't understand. Maybe they have no history with firearms. I'm going to post an article on our page for today. I guess I should tell people that we're airing this the first time December 15th of 2019, so you know which page to go to. But I'm going to put something on there about the 1907 rifle. I'll put that on there during the break here. We're talking to Dr. Peter Pry. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. Something to say. I'm pretty sure that's true. So I just posted on the site, and Dr. Pry, I shot you a quick email. It was the semi-automatic Winchester model 1907. It was a gun that you could buy from Sears and have delivered through the post office. It was a semi-automatic, high-powered centerfire rifle with detachable high-capacity magazine. About 400,000 of these were produced before World War II. Civilians had hundreds of thousands of these semi-automatic rifles for 40 years, while U.S. soldiers were still being issued old-fashioned bolt-action rifles. The 1907 fired just as fast as an AR-15 or an AK-47, and the bullet, which was a .351 Winchester, was actually longer than those fired by more modern-looking weapons. The only functional difference between the 1907 and a controversial and much-feared AR-15 is the modern black plastic stock. So to summarize, the semi-auto so-called assault rifle is 110 years old. It is not new. The semi-auto rifle was not a weapon of war. The government made it a weapon of war 40 years after civilians had them. It could be safely owned by civilians. The proof is literally that three generations of adults owned and used them responsibly and no one ever noticed. So,
one of the great lies perpetuated by the left, and that's being put forth in Virginia, is that semi-automatic weapons are assault weapons,
right,
or assault rifles.
Right.
And that is absolutely untrue. A true assault rifle or assault weapon, weapon of war, the kind that would be used in our military and the kind that are used in militaries all over the world, has a fully automatic option in addition to semi-automatic. You know, the kinds of guns they're talking about confiscating, unless you've got a special federal firearms license, you know, people aren't allowed to buy fully automatic weapons. So this is a big lie, the idea that a semi-automatic weapon, such as the kind that you just described, is an assault rifle or necessarily a weapon of war in the modern context. But another big lie is the idea that the founders did not intend the ordinary citizen to have weapons of war. The Second Amendment was for hunting, for example, or sports, which is completely untrue. You know, the debates over the Second Amendment, you know, in the Federalist Papers make it very clear that the reason for the Second Amendment and arming citizens is so that they are the last defense against tyranny, so they can defend themselves against the possibility of the rise of a tyrannical government. It was basically putting into action the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, et cetera, et cetera. But it goes on to talk about how governments are instituted among men by the consent of the governed. And when governments become destructive of these ends of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is the right of the government, of the governed, to alter or abolish them. That's why we have a Second Amendment, to protect ourselves from the rise of a tyrannical government so that we can alter or abolish it if they try to impose on us. And the kinds of weapons that people owned at the time of the Second Amendment, I mean, one of the absurd arguments that the left makes is that, well, okay, everybody can have single-shot black powder muzzle-loading muskets because that's the kind of weapon that people had when the Second Amendment was written. You know, but those were the standard sidearms of the militaries all
That's
over the
right.
world.
That's
so
right.
the average citizen was entitled to have the most sophisticated firearm of the day, not just muzzle-loading weapons, by the way, but also rifled muskets. And people, if you can go to, you know, private homes in upstate New York and other parts of the colonial America that was part of colonial America and post-colonial America and the post-Revolutionary War period, and find private homes that have cannons, where private individuals had cannons, not just in their homes, but also on flatboats mm-hmm. and things of that sort.
Yeah, nothing wrong with owning a cannon. I mean, come on. Could come
in
handy.
So the Second Amendment is originally understood, permitted private citizens to have weapons that were equal to those of, you know, of the military of the day, precisely because the average citizen was entrusted with being the last defense against tyranny. So one could use that to say people should be allowed to have fully automatic weapons if that's what they wanted. They've already restricted our Second Amendment rights in ways that are very destructive of the original intent. Most hunting rifles and hunting shotguns and things like that, which is what most people own, actually are not even remotely weapons of war. You know, if you take a hunting rifle designed to fire, a .30-06 or something like that, especially, you know, bolt-action rifles, you know, most of them have such fine, tuned bolt-action mechanisms that you can't engage. After you fire a dozen rounds or something like that, you know, it starts losing its accuracy and the rifle starts jamming up. And the same thing with many shotguns. You know, they're not really, literally, are not weapons of war because they wouldn't work well in a situation where you had to actually use them for combat purposes. Now, in Virginia, I think we have a pilot project. The left is looking to Virginia to do to the whole country the next time they get the White House, which they hope will be after the next election. The first thing, just so your audience knows, they're probably not following Virginia politics, but we've got Governor Northrum, who's a far-left Democrat in Virginia, and the Virginia State House has been captured. Both houses, the Senate and House, have been captured by the Democrats. And these people are, I would argue that they're only technically Virginians, the people who now control the government of the state of Virginia. You know, the reason there's been this political shift in Virginia is because of Northern Virginia, where people work basically for the federal government. They work for the federal government in D.C. and in various locations in Northern Virginia and Maryland. And then they commute and live in their suburban homes. And a lot of these people, most overwhelming numbers of them were not originally born in Virginia. They're not really native Virginians. They're people who have come from all over the country who are government-type people, who tend to be liberal people, Democrat people, you know, usually from large urban areas, with the values of large urban areas, and they've gotten jobs in the federal government. And now, in terms of voting, they control the balance of power in Virginia. And so these people are basically what I'd call carpetbaggers. You know, they're outsiders. They're not really native Virginians.
Right.
They occupy only a very small part of the state. You know, 90% of the state, you know, geographically, does not think the way they do, does not have the values they do. And, but they want to start imposing, now that they've captured both houses, they want to start imposing their values by having some of the most restrictive gun control laws in the nation. And they want to start by confiscating, this is what they've talked about, they haven't passed a bill yet, but they've put out the political balloons for a public reaction, to confiscate weapons of war and assault weapons, which they are defining as any kind of a semi-automatic rifle. And there's been enormous protests and pushback by many thousands of Virginians, both against their Democrat members of Congress and against the Democrat State House, and protests of going to the governor's office. And this has led to a rhetorical softening. Governor Northam says he doesn't want to have to throw most Virginians into jail, but he's not really backing off in the substance of what he's saying. He's saying, as long as people register their assault weapons, you know, maybe we can get along that way. Well, we know what registration means and what the implications are for that. You know, very disturbingly, just over this weekend, the idea has been floated by the Democrats in the Virginia State House that the National Guard, the Virginia National Guard, should be mobilized when they pass their gun confiscation laws to enforce those laws. And I found it, frankly, it's scary that the Virginia National Guard has not pushed back against that. They haven't said something like, you know, we're not going to enforce unconstitutional laws that impose on that try to confiscate.
Oh, so they're going to decide.
The common people,
right? They'll decide what guns you can have and what guns you can't. That's going to be huge problem.
Dr. Prize, our hostage for the next hour. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
If it was, he'd understand just a little bit more about the working man.
My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And
who's our sponsor, Bill?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery.
Did I throw you there for a second?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, Pape Machinery is our local John Deere dealer. They handle all ag and turf products for John Deere. And if you are looking for from a mower to a tractor to implements, they've got it. They're also a Honda dealer, so if you want to pick up a generator, you are in California now, so you're gonna need a generator eventually. Go down and see them. They've got all shapes and sizes. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, just off take the Oasis Road exit and head north, and you'll run right into them. And their phone number is 226-9226, or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com. Yeah, go see them. Great shop, too. They can work on anything.
There you have it.
There it is.
So let's see. You can find everything about the program, and we're always happy for all the fun individual sponsors that we have. We really appreciate you guys. You can find it all at wethepeopleradio.us. You also have our contact information if you have ideas for programs or, like one time, like my sound was all screwed up and, you know, someone's shot me an email about that. So we appreciate that. And just a little web note as far as people who listen online to the program during the week when the archives are, well, the archives are always free and they are commercial free during the week there. So a lot of people tune in at that point in time. But the Ukrainians are still pulling a hard number two. Anything out of the U.S., top of the list is Ukraine for listenership. So I'm sure we'll be roped into the impeachment here anytime soon.
We'll be called as witnesses. What have we done there to develop a Ukrainian relationship?
Keep them guessing.
Yeah.
We appreciate you pitching in. So anyway, back to our guest, Dr. Peter Pry.
Yeah, we were talking about Virginia's new gun laws that they're trying to pass and how they're going to determine which guns you're going to get to keep and which ones you're going to have to give up. So let's pick it back up there, Dr. Pry.
Yeah, and the larger message here, the larger lesson we have to learn from Virginia is I think it is the left's plan to use Virginia as an experiment, starting with imposing on the Second Amendment rights to see how much they can get away with, and if this works in Virginia, that they can use it as a model for the rest of the country the next time they capture the White House and the Congress, which they hope will be in the next elections. And the way they're doing it is also, I think, very insidious. You know, because the left, I think, learned from their experience recently, but also even going back to the 60s, that America doesn't want a revolution. America especially doesn't want a left-wing revolution, and it rejects the values of the left. They weren't able to sell that to the country back in the 60s. And whenever they've run a presidential candidate on it, except for Obama, who didn't really run on that left-wing platform, actually Obama ran on a post-racial platform, that if we elected him, it would put the racial divisions behind us and would be and that a vote for him would be a vote for unifying the country and moving past the divisions of the past. And that turned out not to be true, of course. You know, Obama did everything he could to stir up racial and class and gender differences.
He did a really good job, too.
The meat and potatoes of the Democrat Party. But I think the insidious plan in Virginia is to pass Second Amendment laws that will be so draconian that they will spark resistance. They will provoke resistance, maybe even armed resistance, from the citizens of Virginia. One of the scary things that's happened here, actually from the point of view of a Second Amendment supporter like myself, a positive thing, is that 85% of the counties in Virginia, their sheriffs notified the governor. They went on record as saying that they will not enforce laws passed by the Democrat State House and signed into law by Governor Northam. They will not enforce laws that impinge on people's Second Amendment rights and to violate the Constitution. And not only that, but they will deputize the gun owners in their counties. They will deputize them to oppose the imposition of such laws. Now, after that, the Democrats in the Capitol escalated the situation. This is where the suggestion was raised by the Democrats about mobilizing the Virginia National Guard to enforce Governor Northrup's confiscatory gun laws. And the disturbing thing that just happened over this weekend, as we had mentioned earlier in the show, is that the Virginia National Guard, I was hoping that they too would join with the sheriffs and reject enforcement. They would not be used to enforce unconstitutional laws. But they didn't say that. They've decided to take a neutral position, which is kind of disturbing. And they have counseled any member of the Virginia National Guard not to comment to the press on what their views are on this matter. So you've got the battle lines being drawn up here in Virginia for possibly a transition from a cold civil war that's been going on to a hot civil war. And the way the left would like that hot civil war to unfold is by putting conservatives and people who support the Second Amendment in the light of aggressors, because we're pushing back and we're not obeying the law, and they need and they need to put us down and smash us down by mobilizing the military against us, and that's the paradigm, I think, that we could see for the future of this country if these kinds of people gain control of the White House and the Congress. You know, and the formula would be applied after the Second Amendment, after taking away the Second Amendment, in effect, to start working on other things, you know, like religious freedom and religious conscience, you know, shutting up down Catholic schools, for example, that might teach that gay marriage is unethical and is not acceptable.
Well, and they're dying to get rid of the Electoral College so they can have their cities vote for all of our presidents.
Right. That, you know, that public policy based on the idea that there are two biological sexes is somehow homophobic and evil, and we need to be thinking of public policy in terms of 26 genders. The whole left-wing agenda on sexual politics, on green politics, environmentalism and all the rest, and controlling our lives, you know, if they can make this work for taking away people's Second Amendment rights, then look for all of the Bill of Rights to be under assault by the left until they can remake America in their image.
Well, if they want to take a look at what it's going to look like, come to California, because they've implemented a lot of those laws. The whole assault weapons, the 10-round magazines. If you want to buy ammunition, you have to
you have to
pass a test and get a permit and pay $25 a year.
Wait, before you leave that one, not only do you have to have a permit, basically, to buy ammunition, but because they gave driver's licenses to illegal aliens in California, the driver's license is no longer a form of ID. So now people have to go through all the hoops of getting a real ID before they can get past the test to get the ammunition.
Right. Or fly on an airplane or a lot of things.
So in honor of the insanity that is that, let's take a quick break and play a little song, because the Eagles wrote a little song about it, and it's kind of true today and coming to a town near you in Virginia.
Said, we are all just prisoners here of our own device. And in the master's chambers, they gathered for the feast. They stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. Last thing I remember, I was running for the door.
We'll sing a victory tune and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
There we go. The new Virginia theme song.
So, Dr. Pry, what's the time frame on this? These passing these laws in Virginia?
I think you'll see it in the spring. You know, they're playing the verbal chess games now, but the state legislature convenes in the spring, and that's when we will see this begin to happen, see this begin to unfold. You know, you had mentioned, you know, as goes, you want to see the future of the country, you know, look to California. And I have to say, I agree with that. Except I think it'll be far worse once they get hold of the whole country, if they capture White House, capture the Congress. But I had a speaking engagement last year in Los Angeles and hadn't been to L.A. since I had been a student at USC in 1984. 1984 was my last recollection of Los Angeles. And I just didn't recognize the city. I was, my host who had me out there was obviously a wealthy businessman. He lived in a mansion on a little mountain overlooking, probably in the San Bernardino Mountains or something, overlooking Los Angeles. And when he drove me across the city, you know, to go to where I was supposed to speak, I mean, it looked like a third world country. Mm-hmm. The streets were just filled with homeless people.
Yes.
The city was basically transformed into a tent city with people literally living in tents all over the sidewalks. Streets basically not drivable anymore because people were just, you know, wandering down the streets, and some of them, and many of them, in wheelchairs, and obviously people very poor, very sick, and probably very drug addicted. And we managed to get through all that and then went up the other side to another high point where I met with other wealthy businessmen to basically give them my, you know, give them my presentation. And the difference between 1984, Los Angeles in 1984, and Los Angeles in 2018, which is when I was there, is just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. You know, the city has basically, that I knew, has ceased to exist and been replaced with this dystopian nightmare. And I suspect that's, you know, in addition to people losing their freedoms and civil rights, they can look forward to a not prosperous, hellish kind of a future. And I listening to you guys, I really enjoy your radio show. I enjoy you both as people, talking to you. But how can you stand it? How can you live in California?
We live in land far,
are you
far
in
away.
Little isolated Shangri-La type valley,
kind
of, that is you know, safe from the predations of the of the left wing monsters. Or
well, we're like 10.5 hours north of L.A.
Yeah, we don't.
So we're just below the Oregon border.
Yeah, we have our homeless issues. Don't get me wrong, we do have some of that. We don't have people camping on the sidewalks, and
well, we kind of do.
Well, yeah, but
not anything like
LA.
Like,
no,
yeah.
But it's coming. We see it every year. It gets a little bit worse and a little bit worse. We don't really have any representation up here.
Well, our congressional district, just to give you a frame of reference, our congressional district here covers 11 counties, 11 of the 58 counties in California.
Yeah, and so that's how land mass wise, it's about the size of half the East Coast.
Yeah, and our really big town is the one we live in. It has 90,000 people.
Yeah, so it's a world of difference from L.A. or even San Francisco, which is, again, another city that's, I think, lost. You know, when these cities get down to that level, I don't know how you turn that around. I mean, the police, imagine going into an area like that and trying to investigate crimes or even just police it when you have people that are basically out of the system. They don't live on the grid, so to speak. And there's so many of them. I'm not sure how you come back from that.
Yeah, I agree. The situation is almost literally the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of diseases that had once been vanquished in this country are coming back in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. I understand San Francisco lost a high-tech fair that was actually started in San Francisco by the Silicon Valley, but they're not even going to be meeting in the state anymore. They're meeting someplace else because of the danger to people who want to participate in this fair from just walking the streets of San Francisco.
Yep.
Try to go from hotels to go to where the convention would be because of things like, you know, needles on the sidewalks and just the all the garbage and the human feces and the risk of possibly catching some kind of disease out of the Middle Ages that that used to be vanquished in this country. It's really, really disturbing. And you guys should call yourselves Radio Free California, maybe. I mean, it's really sort of like, you know, like you're living in some little isolated paradise.
We kind of are. I mean, I think we're the second. I think our county is first or second per capita in concealed weapons permits in the state of California.
Yeah, I think we're second most.
It's like, I don't know, 5,000-7,000 people, something. It's a big number. So people here actually care about their rights and have not willingly thrown them over. As they have in some of the
other
parts of the state.
But both our houses are democratically controlled, the Senate and the Assembly.
Yeah, California, what term limits look like?
Yeah.
You get to be totally controlled by the agencies.
Yeah, there's something wrong with our system. People are always talking about reforming our system in a leftward direction. But maybe we need to be thinking about reforming it in a conservative direction, because it doesn't seem fair when you've got such a huge geographical part of your state, even though it's sparsely inhabited, but you basically have no representation.
No.
You have no political voice. I used to live in southern Maryland, and it was a similar situation, where southern Maryland is very conservative, they're very Catholic, they're very much about gun rights. The people who live there are mostly hunters and fishermen, many of them related to the original settlers going back to the 1630s when Maryland was originally a Catholic colony that had been established. But these people have no representation. They have no representation in the state house. They have no representation in the Congress. The Democrats are so totally in control because of the way they've gerrymandered, you know, that state. How come the Democrats always get away with gerrymandering, but when the Republicans try to do it, it never seems to work? And people all, and the press is all about, oh, those evil Republicans. The Democrats gerrymander all the time and do it apparently successfully.
We do kind of suck at that kind of stuff.
You know, a lot of their political power is based on that.
Right. Well, you look at you just look at some of the players that are coming out of our state here, and that tells you how out of touch people are.
Yes,
you know, Nancy Pelosi, Maxine Waters, Adam Schiff.
Right,
and they're, you know, people get mad about it. They act like Congress elects itself. I'm like, you have to remember, there were a lot of voters.
This is what happens when you...
The electorate is the cause of this.
They're elected by the big cities, you know, the places that don't want guns and, you know, think guns are dangerous. That's who's electing these people. And that's got to change.
But
you know, one of the ironies of... we had been talking about how important the Second Amendment was as a constitutional right. But, you know, as a practical... right to stave off tyranny and to defend the interests of the little guy and the working man and of minorities, there's a history there where gun ownership has had a practical effect on our politics. It's not taught in the history classes. It's not a politically correct thing to talk about anything about American history, and particularly nothing that would support gun rights, but almost from the very beginning, you know, after the American Republic was founded, there was Shays Rebellion, for example, which was among the revolutionary soldiers who were disappointed that the promised pay that they were wasn't forthcoming from Congress. And so there was an armed revolt among a lot of those veterans of the American Revolution. Now, it was put down, but the Congress ended up coughing up the money for those veterans after getting a scare from them because of that uprising. There was the Whiskey Rebellion. You know, George Washington put that down, but it did soften, you know, and slowed the encroachment of the federal government into people who wanted to engage in distilling and doing that as a business, and without interference from the revenuers from Washington. You know, after the we of course had the American Civil War, which everybody might take that as an example of why you shouldn't have gun ownership. But let's face it, had we not had an armed citizenry on both sides, you know, the fundamental issues that were resolved in that war, for good or ill, whether it came, you know, minority rights, racial, you know, rights, the end of slavery, as well as the continued existence of the United States, you know, was resolved once and for all in a way that might never have been resolved.
Oh, absolutely.
And the aftermath of the American Civil War, the Jim Crow period, you know, if it had not been for the fact that the black farmers were armed and had guns in the South, you know, the Ku Klux Klan might have wiped them out altogether. You know, there was actually a conspiracy, not just by the Klan, but by the Southern governments who, in the aftermath of Reconstruction, who rejected Reconstruction and rejected, after the radical Republican effort at Reconstruction, was kicked out of the South in 1876 by a political deal. It was, you know, the state governments actually became instruments of oppression against black people who wanted to vote, who wanted to have education, who wanted to enjoy the normal civil liberties. And the only thing that kept them from being wiped out was the fact that they owned guns. You know, the Virginia, the labor unions, you know, the armed labor unions fought against the Pinkertons, and eventually earned the right to that violence. It was a contributing factor. It wasn't just the goodness of the hearts of the elites, but the fact that people were willing to fight for their labor union rights, won the right for organized labor. The U.S. Army was actually called out before World War I in the early 1900s to put down coal miner strikes in West Virginia, you know, because they were so angry about the dangerous working conditions that were being imposed upon them, and conditions where they weren't allowed to unionize, that they armed themselves and fought back against the Army. Now, they lost, but again, you know, the fact that people were willing to defend their rights, mm-hmm. and that were armed and capable of doing it, you know, scared the powers that be enough so that those rights actually were forthcoming, and we ended up having better working conditions for the miners and safety conditions, even up into our own day. If you look at, you know, the Black Panthers, I mean, in addition to the peaceful civil rights movement that was led by Reverend Martin Luther King, you know, there were violent civil rights activists, including the Black Panthers, who were an armed force and wanted a separate Black America and wanted to secede from the United States. But obviously, that was never realistic. That wasn't a benign thing. It wasn't a good thing. But it was a good thing that they were able to show that force of arms, which was a contributing factor to the civil rights legislation that was passed to try to quell the civil war that was brewing in this country in the 60s. And I find it really ironic that when you look at most of these courses where gun ownership, the Second Amendment, has resulted in reforms and progress that have helped labor and minorities, and there are causes that had been favored historically by the left. Causes that in American universities, you can get a degree in labor history, for example, and study, you know, the armed rebellions of organized labor.
But they forgot how they got
they
there.
Because these guys had guns, you
right,
know?
Exactly. Right.
But
we have to take
don't
a really...
to make the connection that in the left or in our universities about how the Second Amendment isn't just sensible because of a theoretical threat from tyranny, but it has actually had a positive real effect in our history in moving the country in directions that have made life better for everybody. You know, because you can't trust state, you can't trust government, especially in cahoots with with big business, to always do the right thing.
Well,
the little guy is always going to get shafted.
For the folks who
The Second Amendment has been a safeguard against that.
Yes, and for the people who want to see that in present day, I mean, you look at where most of these shootings happen, they're in gun-free zones. So there's a reason for that. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You are listening to We the People.
Now I know what's right. I got just one life. Aren't pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand. Langley recently with a plain and simple dream. Wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their mansions and cases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on. Got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my weapon drawn. So I get my handcuffs, my cyanide pills, my classified dossier. Timing the phones like, shredding the files like, and memorized all the enemy's spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA.
Couldn't resist. We had to play the CIA song.
So, Aaron Ryan, are we going to stand our ground? Are we going to knock back down?
Exactly.
I really love these songs you've been playing that are so appropriate to our theme today.
Well, we've been we've literally been training for this for a lot of years. You think about the music that a lot of us grew up with, and that's... It's just funny to look at it in the context of what's going on politically now. It's like, wow, they were ahead of, you know, we were ahead of ourselves in some ways. I don't see people knuckling under for that. I mean, I, at least in this area, people are becoming pretty strident about their gun rights. Actually, they filed a lawsuit. A guy who lives just in the county north of us has filed a suit for open carry that's still going.
Well, hallelujah, and good for them.
Yeah, he found it.
Far from knuckling down. People are ready for open revolt here in Virginia over it. In fact, I can't remember if I did mention it, if I failed to mention it, it's terrible oversight, but 85% of the counties here in Virginia have now passed, in anticipation of these gun confiscation laws, they have now passed what they call Second Amendment sanctuary counties.
Oh, so yeah, you said that in your
county
email.
I live in, Spotsylvania County. Second Amendment, they have made themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries. You know, so a place where to put the state government on notice and the governor on notice that if they pass laws that are considered are crossing the line and look like there are going to be draconian restrictions on people's Second Amendment rights, they're not going to be obeyed. They're not going to be enforced. We're Second Amendment sanctuaries now. So people are not backing off. They're not going to back down. They're going to stand their ground. And I'll tell you, I personally am going to stand my ground here. You know, if they want me to register my so-called assault rifle, I'm going to tell the governor he can go pound salt. You know, I'm not going to participate in my own eventual disarmament.
Well, the problem with California was, is again, without representation, those laws were passed as far as the assault weapons went. And now if you own one of those guns, you have to register it as an assault weapon and get a permit for it, which everybody knows the next step is then we're going to recall them and we know you have it, so it'll go away. Or you have to disassemble it, and you can keep it stored in a disassembled position. You can then keep it and not register it. If you want to transport it, you have to lock it in a box.
Transport's a big deal.
And so it's just almost impossible. And then, of course, you have to get a license to buy the ammunition for it. So this is all stuff that I think, once it comes to California and it gets passed, other states like Virginia are going to go, hey, we can do that and maybe even do one better and take another big step to basically banning the ownership of firearms. It's inevitable.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the thing that is one of the things that makes me so angry about all this is that I think that they ultimately, I don't even think they want people to comply with the law. Not here in Virginia. They're being so pushy, confrontational about it. I think they are hoping that people will defy the law and that there will be a confrontation, maybe even violence, so that they can now use Virginia as a test bed for
right.
using the Virginia National Guard, you know, the bringing the military power to bear on the conservative people, on the common people, and putting us down forcibly.
And I don't
shove this down our throats.
Yeah, and I don't. I would like to believe that our National Guard or our military would not raise arms against the citizens. You know, I know they swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, but they're violating the Constitution by taking weapons away from the citizens. So I don't know. It's the last thing I'd want to see happen, but you know, they're going to push it too far, and once we start down that road, it's going to get real ugly, and people are going to die.
I agree. That's why I think that we might see the transition in Virginia from a cold civil war to a hot civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner than people think, you know, even before President Trump's out of office, because the Virginia State Legislature, I think this is going to be the first thing they're going to do, and they're going to push it as hard as they and far as they can come spring.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Funny,
to see
the last
happens.
Civil War started, was basically largely waged in Virginia, you know, and here maybe this will be the second American Civil War, and for the future of the country, and it looks like Virginia once again is going to be the battleground state.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something?
Interesting how. I suppose with your field of study, and we use the expression all the time, but history does repeat itself. And hearkening back to our original idea that civilization has come to a close before, and we had to wander in the desert for a very long time, it's not an impossibility. We could walk ourselves into that in a number of ways. This mm-hmm. is not the least of which. How about let's take a really quick break, just a couple of seconds early, and then come right back and finish up top of the hour with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
All gave some, and some gave all, and some stood through for the red, white, and blue, and some had to fall.
some gave all.
You know, I think about those people when we're busy playing fast and loose with all of our, all the liberties that these people fought for. We had, I just was able to meet a lady last month who turned 100 years old. She was a nurse at the Battle of the Bulge and went down the ropes on the side of the ship in her pumps and her stockings and her skirt and got in the landing craft and got through the 5 feet of water. And, you know, you look at what has happened. There's a guy here in Reading, actually. He's a Pearl Harbor survivor. He turns 100 this month. And he was in Normandy also at the Battle of the Bulge. So there are these people who have seen the history of our country and world history, and they're watching these kinds of things go on. I mean, I'm frustrated. We're all frustrated, but I can only imagine how, I mean, you'd be beside yourself.
Yeah, we've been talking, we were talking in the first hour about the collapse of civilization in the past and the advent of dark ages in the past because barbarians figured out how to knock the technological props out from under the critical infrastructures that supported those civilizations. And one of the things that has, you know, one of the greatest revolutions in the history of civilization, I think, was the birth of the United States based on a Constitution and Bill of Rights. It's not a technological piece of infrastructure that holds our society up. I mean, there are those things. But what makes us special and unique in history, the freedoms that we enjoy, are based on that intellectual infrastructure that's embodied in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And when I look at people like Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, you know, the barbarians are in our gates.
Mm-hmm.
These people have no conception of our own history.
No.
They have no understanding of the Constitution. I mean, it makes my skin crawl to hear them talking about, oh, we're a nation of laws, not men, as they proceed to shred the Constitution with their crazy... they're as bad as the Nazis and communists at a show trial trying to fob off their reasons for impeaching the president with this nonsense.
Well, they actually just put a modern twist on it when they did their little focus group and came up with bribery and all that never had anything to do with the articles of impeachment, but they thought it would sound better during the hearings.
Right.
Like,
their barbarians are in our gates, and they're shredding the Constitution on television in front of our own eyes. And there might be no coming back from it, you know, because constitutional republics are so fragile. They depend upon an educated citizenry and an educated leadership, which we don't have. You know, at least half of the political leadership in this country, represented by the Democrat Party, doesn't believe in the Constitution. Not really. They just pay lip service to it. You know, they believe in power, and that's all they understand, their personal power and the power of their party. They're so partisan. And they regard the other half of their citizens. I mean, that's one of the other magical and unique things about constitutional republics, is that when people are like-minded in their values, you know, about the rule of law, about agreement on the Constitution, agreement in the Bill of Rights, when you have that, really and truly, the sides aren't supposed to be able to see themselves, they can't see each other as enemies, because they have so much in common, more in common than they have, but that's obviously not the case in our country. You know, we're obviously locked in a cold civil war that might be on the verge of going hot, because there's an enormous schism in our values between an America that still believes in constitutionalism and does believe in the rule of law, and America and the other half of America that doesn't, and is just engaged in a naked power grab so they control all of us, and that we're perceived as the enemy by these people. These people truly do see us as an enemy to what they regard as the inevitable progress of history. People clinging to our guns and Bibles and, you know, don't have a scientific approach. And it's disgusting how ignorant and stupid the people are that are shredding our Constitution. I mean, contrast someone who's a true constitutional scholar, like a Mark Levin, for example, or an Alan Dershowitz, who's a man of the left, even, you know, with Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff. Just truly, they are, you know, truly barbarians who do not understand what the American project is about, and they don't care. And they're in the process of destroying it. They're going to be in the process of destroying it all in front of us next week on television when they go forward with this phony impeachment. And it could well trigger. I mean, it is going to be knocking the intellectual props out from under our civilization, this magical American civilization that has to this point been the most successful and most prosperous and most importantly the most free society and the most tolerant society ever to exist in history. And that could all start to go away next week. And let's not forget, it's not just a question of us doing it to ourselves. Do you think Russia and China and North Korea and Iran are not watching? They are watching.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
You know, they are watching, and their general staffs are making calculations. This coming year is going to be one of the most dangerous in American history. I wonder what Kim Jong-un's promised Christmas present is for America. You know, they're getting so bold, you know, because they think this president has been weakened. And he has been weakened by impeachment and divisions. You know, these guys are probably thinking to themselves, you know, could I grab South Korea and would America be so preoccupied with itself? Or could I attack America itself at this juncture and, you know, do it in an anonymous way? Or people who could doubt that most of the mainstream media wouldn't blame President Trump if this country was attacked, and President Trump would end up coming out as the bad guy and the enemy, and that we wouldn't be pulling together, unified, to defend ourselves against any of these foreign adversaries that want to do us in and end the American experiment. Because freedom is always a threat to tyranny. They're so happy to see us destroying our own freedoms. But I'm not sure that they're going to just rely upon us to end American civilization all on their own. They'll be happy to help.
Right. No, and we are, I mean, when you look at what's going on in D.C. right now, we're pretty vulnerable to outside influence. And, I mean, we need to really kind of step away and take a look at what's going on. With the attacks on the president, because this isn't going to be just a liberal versus conservative thing because Trump's in office. It's going to happen with every president from now on.
Yeah, they've started a really bad precedent. You don't like him? Oh, okay. Well, we're going to impeach him.
How it can go this far when basically they're. Is such flimsy evidence.
If we're fortunate enough to have future presidents, if we're fortunate enough.
Well, that's true.
Which, you know, we have to survive through the next year. And then another thing that has to happen is that the Trump administration has to successfully prosecute this coup d'etat, which is what it is. I'm really disturbed that nobody's gone to jail yet.
Oh, you, and, you and a lot of people.
Going to jail, and it may be that none of them ever will go to jail. If that happens, it'll be sending a signal to the deep state that they can get away with this.
Yep.
And so we might call a future president a president, but if they're elected through a coup d'etat, through illegal means, you know, they're not really a president anymore.
No.
They've become a tyrant, you know, a part of our civilization that isn't described in the Constitution, but that the founders feared most. You know, which was our own national security apparatus, you know, that has become an entity unto itself, a power unto itself, and decides to make itself a kingmaker.
Right.
And that's what happened to the Romans. That's what destroyed the Roman Republic, you know, the Praetorian Guard and the bureaucracy, you know, becoming so powerful that the Senate didn't matter anymore. And, you know, and force is what ruled the day, not law.
Well, and when you say it sends a message to the deep state, you know what? It also sends a message to the to the people of this country that there's two sets of laws now. You know, the ones that we have to live by and the laws that they
the
have
people.
To live by.
We, the yeah. little people.
And that is that's really dangerous because, I mean, that's what's going to fire off a civil war was when people feel that they have to comply to a different set of laws.
Well, and, you know, we should... I don't think anybody would be surprised because what have we been hearing for years, right? That we live in a democracy. I'm not sure which part of the republic skipped them, but they always refer to us as a democracy. And then we start talking about getting rid of the Electoral College that people don't understand anyway. And if we have no say, we are no longer a representative republic.
Yeah, that's right. Even the fact that we've been calling ourselves a democracy is not right, you know? I mean, I know that's a common term of art that's used to describe what people mean as a free people. But a democracy, a constitutional republic is not a democracy.
Mm-mm.
You know,
no.
The founders rejected the idea of democracy, you know, because it was prone to demagoguery, and minority rights were not respected.
And just
democracies
a teeny bit of mob
have a bad
rule.
Habit of quickly devolving into tyrannies. And that's why we have a constitutional republic. It was try to correct the errors in the past and the Athenian Greek city-state that was a pure democracy and the errors that they also saw in the constitutional republic
with
the Roman Republic before it became an imperial tyranny.
Dr. Yep. Fry, we have hit the wall here, so we've got to say goodbye for this particular episode with you. We appreciate you coming on with us, and in honor of this next week's impeachment madness, we're going to play a little Twilight Zone here before we go. You're listening to We the People. Join us online.
Thanks, Dr. Fry.
Radio.us.